Before I introduce our guest today, I do want to remind you that we have another speaker next week. We have Mike Taylor coming, a graduate of UVA Law School. And he will be, I like to think of it as sort of food safety continued, since we'll start with food safety today. So let me introduce our guest today. It gives me great pleasure to introduce William K. Hubbard. Mr. Hubbard recently retired, theoretically, as Senior Associate Commissioner for Policy and Planning at FDA. He was 25 years in the Commissioner's office. In his latest position, he advised the Commissioner on agency policy, coordinated the development of the agency's rulemaking, and oversaw planning and evaluation functions of FDA. He has had a lifetime of public service, serving first in the House, then Department of Education, and then EPA before coming to FDA for more than 25 years. He claims to have retired. This is his third presentation of the day. And if you look at his other activities, you will see that that's in name only, I would say. He is senior advisor to the Coalition for a Stronger FDA, and he has been consulted both by Congress and by the media as an expert in the direction the FDA should be taking. So without further ado, William K. Hubbard.
Thank you, baby. I'm glad you got Mike Taylor coming, because he actually knows something about food safety. And so ignore everything I say and listen to what Mike says. It's great to be here in Charlottesville. As usual, it takes 2 hours to do the 200 miles here and then an hour to do the last 2 miles. So I expected that. Well, you know, my daughter went to school here, and I hated driving on 29, but I think it's even worse now with the it seems to be a stoplight every mile from Culpeper to Manassas. And those of you that commute from the Northwest, I sympathize with. Anyway, I'm not doing a legal thing today. I'm not a lawyer, but I was at FDA a long time, and I know a lot about it, I think. And so I'm going to try to give you a sense of kind of what's going on there and some of the key challenges, and with particular emphasis on some food safety and this recent issue with imports that we all are seeing in the news from China and all that. So let me just mention, I'm going to give you a little bit of background, a little bit about FDA and how it does, why it doesn't do well in some areas, some of the major issues confronting the agency, and then, as I said, we'll dig a little deeper into the import issue, which is a hot issue at the moment. So first of all, I think you know this, so I won't spend a lot of time. Science-based regulatory agency, organized by foods, drugs, devices, kinds of things they do. All over the Washington area, they've never been able to get a single campus, although there's some effort to do that now. They're all over the country because the FDA needs to be where the industry is because, of course, they are regulators. And they have about 10,000 people, and most of them are scientists. I was somewhat unusual there to be a senior official at FDA as an English major, but I try to understand the lingo at least. And their budget's about $2 billion, although a big chunk of that is in user fees paid by the drug industry that I'll mention in a moment. I think you've had some history, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. FDA was created during the progressive era, the turn of the century. You've heard about the jungle and all that. Lots of reasons why there needed to be some sort of structure put over foods and drugs. Foods were widely adulterated. People added talcum powder to sugar and sawdust to flour, and that was very common. There weren't really any drugs in those days. There was digoxin and aspirin and a couple of others. Most drugs were 90% alcohol, and you felt a little better because you got a little high, and so you thought it worked. And so the drug industry actually grew up around the FDA, and that, in some ways, I think is a reason that the drug and food industries are successful, because they didn't get hit with that sort of huge regulatory burden that, for instance, EPA had to impose. The Modern Act was created in 1938. The 06 Act was basically a failure. Those of you who've taken that, didn't really work, too weak. The one provision, however, that was carried over from the 06 Act was the provision for imports. And we'll talk about that, because in 1938 they said, hey, imports work pretty well. In fact, an import provision predates the FDA. It goes back to 1896. So we'll talk about that in a moment. In the 50s, they got some new authorities. In 62, the big change occurred when a drug was causing serious birth defects, and cause the creation of the efficacy standard. So the drugs had to be shown to work as well as be safe. Oddly, it was a safety issue and it caused an efficacy standard, but who knows. Then radiological products, cell phones, x-rays, all that came along, not cell phones actually, but TVs and anything emitting radiation came to the FDA in the 60s. Medical devices got modern authority in the 70s. There was a toxicological research center created out of an old germ warfare operation in Arkansas in 1970, and the concept of biologics were moved from the National Institutes of Health over to FDA. At the same time, the Drug Enforcement Administration was spun off to Justice, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission was spun off to a separate agency. And then lastly, some user fees were enacted to deal with drug review problems in the 1990s, and that begat some problems we're going to mention in a moment. Now, this is a very brief rundown. There's a much richer history here of FDA. For those of you who care, I hope you learn about it. For those of you who don't care, you've got a little bit. Okay, now, as I say, FDA has a big mission. I mean, we all know that they do a lot of stuff. And just about everything you consume or use in terms of medication or cosmetics or whatever are regulated by the FDA. So they touch all of our lives every day. And in fact, FDA regulates about a quarter of consumer spending. So it's a huge economic effect when you look at a regulatory agency that regulates so much. And they're in the news a lot. You see, FDA did this, FDA did that. Not necessarily because the agency did a good or bad job, but because people care about all these things they put in their bodies and use. Now, they have a big industry to oversee. Lots of factories, warehouses, and other firms. That in itself is a major task, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But even more so, worldwide, more and more imports are coming in, and their responsibility is huge all around the world. And we're going to get to a moment as to whether any of this is actually being examined by the FDA. They're all around the country, as you might expect, because they're where the industry is. So obviously lots of folks in New Jersey and other places. Where the industry is, and you'll see in some of the western states, there's not much of an FDA presence because there's not many manufacturing facilities. Now, FDA has had, in my view, a very successful history generally. It was one of the creators of what I will call, for the purposes of this, the modern safety net. We all now expect safety in the products we use. We all believe that someone, the government, someone is making sure that products we use every day are safe. And FDA was one of the first to step in and set standards for production of products, standards for chemicals used in products, and many other things about the system of purchasing and using products. And other agencies that came along were able to build upon FDA's experience as a science-based regulatory agency. So I think FDA was a very important agency throughout the 20th century. Drug review times were a huge issue from the 70s through the 90s. Every Secretary of Health and Human Services and Commissioner of Food and Drug spent tons of their time worrying about drug review times. All they heard was, in Europe, drugs are approved in a year. In the United States, they're approved in 3 years. Patients were going to France and England and Germany to get drugs. It was viewed as a major problem. And only when a UVA law school graduate wrote a bill in 1992 to solve that, did that really get fixed? Although now there are some drug safety issues we're going to get to in a minute. The concept of deciding what can safely go into a food and how food should properly be made was something the FDA developed over the 20th century and did a very good job. And today, people everywhere look to those sorts of standards for safe food. Blood safety, I mentioned as an example of a new problem that came along, in this case in the 80s with the advent of the AIDS epidemic, in which a heretofore relatively non-problematic area became a problem because of the obvious transmission of disease from blood. And FDA was able, in this case, and other similar ones, to step in and put in place some new requirements that work. But one of the reasons I raise this is that what really was happening in that period was that as new problems came along, commissioners and others in those days were shifting money out of food. And so we're going to talk about that later. But some of the problems that got solved like this were solved at the expense of other things. Because in my view, FDA's been playing a big game of whack-a-mole in recent years, and I'll explain that a little bit more later. Internationally, FDA has traditionally been viewed as the go-to place for how to properly regulate. In fact, when Vice President Gore signed an MOU with the former Soviet republics a few years ago, it was noted that FDA essentially was approving three-quarters of the world's crops. That those countries and countries in developing countries and obviously the United States were all looking to the FDA to be the gatekeeper for the approval of new drugs. And in other areas such as foods and similar areas, FDA was often looked to as the model for science-based effective regulation. Now that is changing some, and I'm going to say a little bit about that in a moment. Another thing, if anybody ever says to you that the food and drug industries are overregulated, don't believe it, because they are among the most competitive, they are very strong industries with a strong positive balance of trade. And I think that, in a way, it's proof positive that FDA does not overregulate, that these industries are able to be incredibly successful. And my own philosophy is that, in many cases, they're successful because of the FDA. The French did a study a few years ago in which they were asking why no one would buy French drugs outside of France. And the reason is they had a low efficacy standard. Doctors were voting with their prescribing pens for American drugs. And I ask you, has anybody here ever seen a Japanese car or Japanese audio equipment? You have? Good. Has anybody here ever used a Japanese drug? Can you name a Japanese drug? Can you name a Japanese drug company? I can do one, Kawasawa. Yeah, okay, two. I mean, because they didn't put in place a standard after World War II. When they were building their industry, they focused on other industries. They didn't think they could catch up with the United States. I remember the Japanese came to us a few years ago and said, "We want in. How do you do this? We want to develop our drug industry now. Will you teach us? Because there's a lot of money to be made." And we, Japanese use a lot of dietary supplement type of things. And they have to buy a lot of their drugs from us. They didn't want to be buying the drugs. They wanted to be making the drugs. But the point is, the American drug industry is incredibly profitable and competitive, partly, I believe, because the FDA says you're not going to get on the market unless you work well and you're safe. The bar is very high. Now, if a drug executive was here, he probably would quarrel with that, but he's not here, so I can say it. Labeling. There are lots of successes in the labeling area. Most of you are too young to realize it. Before the nutrition facts label was done just a few years ago, you didn't get anything. You got a box with something in it. You didn't know what was in it. You might have a green label, but you didn't have any nutrition information. And what information they would give you was often wrong. They would say high-fat foods were low-fat. Low-fiber foods were high-fiber. It didn't matter. Nobody was doing anything about it. And I think this was a success story for the FDA. And in fact, when at the very end of this process, the food industry and the Department of Agriculture opposed the FDA, tried to kill the label. And there was a big showdown with the president at the time. And FDA prevailed, and I think that was a victory. If you'd ever seen over-the-counter drug labels a few years ago, they were run together in 4 or 5 point type. I don't even think you could read them with your good eyesight. I know I couldn't. So there have been successes in those areas. So I think FDA has been, in many ways, a very successful regulatory agency in setting up a standard of care for products that has given consumers a high level of confidence in consumer products. But I think that's changing. Now let's talk a little bit about some things that are going on that are a problem. First of all, Vioxx and other things have clearly caused in the public mind a feeling that drugs are not safe, that FDA is going too fast, is in the pocket of the drug industry or otherwise not overseeing the drug safety system correctly. I think later on you're going to get a lecture about the new bill that just passed called FDARA, and that will explain some of the things that were done to improve drug safety. And I think there's some very important provisions in there. But what fundamentally happened, in my view, was the user fees came in from the drug industry that I mentioned earlier, got more reviewers in place, moved the applications through so that drugs were on the market, and then you didn't have that concomitant post-marketing side where people were looking at the adverse reactions from marketed drugs. And so that, I think, will be partially addressed by the new bill, which hopefully you'll learn a lot more about in a few weeks. There are lots of products that FDA has simply been unable to regulate. They simply do not have the authority or resources. I mentioned dietary supplements as one. Now, many people use dietary supplements essentially as drugs. And if polls show that people often think they have medicinal effects. Legally, they're foods, and I assume you'll be learning about that. But when FDA tried to do more oversight of dietary supplements in the early 1990s, the health food industry and use of these products was so outraged they went to Congress in floods to get that changed. And in fact, members of Congress would tell us they got more mail on that subject than any since the Vietnam War, which is pretty dramatic. And then Congress, as a result, passed a law called DSHEA that essentially deregulated them, but worse than that, from the pieces of regulation that were left, FDA was given no funding. Now, there are other examples. Over-the-counter drugs are poorly regulated. Drugs that have been on the market many years. Cosmetics. There are lots of commodities there for which the regulatory system, I believe, has essentially stepped aside. Inspections are woefully inadequate. And I'm going to give you some data on this. Domestically, there's some, but way too little. Internationally, they're almost non-existent, and I'm going to show you some data in a moment on that. And people are beginning to be more and more worried about foodborne disease because we have the equivalent of the World Trade Center attack every 8 months in this country. 5,000 people die from foodborne illness every year. 76 million people get sick from foodborne disease, and we accept it probably way too readily. And then I think we have a completely broken import system. And I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to drill down a little bit more on that in a couple of minutes. But what's going on with these failures, in my view, is that public confidence is failing. There was a time in which if there was a drug safety problem or food safety problem, the Secretary of Health and Human Services or the Commissioner of Food and Drugs could stand up and say, we're on the case, you can consume this product or don't do this. And I think people are beginning to lose that confidence. This is a remarkable change in people's opinions. During most of my career at FDA, we were very proud that in Harris polls, Roper polls, Washington Post polls, FDA usually came in second in public confidence only to the National Park Service. And while people didn't really know in depth what FDA did, they had a good sense that there's this agency that worries about these commodities and is doing an okay job. And this really worries me. And I think BIOS plays into this. But if the public's losing confidence, I think it is clearly a marker that something is amiss. Now, I make this point because up here on the very left-hand corner, the laws that were passed for FDA the first 75 years of the agency's existence. This column, and much of this column is the last 15 years. So what's going on? Why would Congress give FDA a few statutes to enact for 75 years and all of a sudden flood it? I think part of the reason is that because FDA is not doing a great job and is under-resourced, the problem is going to get solved. So Congress solves the problem by passing another law. Now guess how many of those laws, by the way, came with appropriated dollars? Anyone guess? So they just get more work and then fail more. So you've got this sinking agency, in my view, that cannot keep up, couldn't keep up before, and can't keep up even less now. So I try to tell industry folks that if they think keeping FDA barefoot and pregnant, as they say, is helping them, they're wrong, because the public's going to get the problem solved some way. They're not going to buy the product, or they're going to change some other behavior, or they're going to sue the companies, or they're going to get the law changed. And if you had an effective FDA, a lot of these laws would never have been needed. And I think the industry is beginning to realize that. I'm working with this group called Coalition for a Stronger FDA. That's a really unique group. I was asked to go to a meeting last fall in this fancy club in Washington, and here we had all these captains of industry and consumer groups and patient groups. And I was asked to make a presentation, some of the kind of information I'm showing you. And at the end, they all sort of said, well, we're kind of all suffering from this, because the industry is beginning to realize that if they don't have the FDA behind them, they're in trouble. And consumer groups have long felt that FDA was going downhill. And so they all sort of talked among themselves and said, you know, guys, we don't agree on anything policy-wise, but we do agree on this. So they formed this thing called the Coalition for Stronger FDA that is attempting to lobby Congress and the administration for more money. But it's a tough sell, I'll tell you. We can talk about it more if you'd like to know. So let me give you a sense of how FDA looks at its budget. Now, if you look at the top numbers, it looks like, hey, $1.28 billion going up to $1.78 billion in the last year. That's pretty good, right? Notice how you've got user fees, so-called earmarks, money to build buildings, stuff like that. The way FDA looks at it is this core function. The only thing above the line in terms of programmatic function is drug review. Drug safety, food safety, cosmetics, dietary supplements, everything that they do is down here. And they see that going down. There's a better way to show it, though. The FDA is an agency of people. They don't get grants. They don't get contracts. They either do something or they don't. And if people do it, or it doesn't get done. And so let's look at people. Now, again, it looks like they're better off. They had over 9,000. They got over 10,000. If you take out the burgundy, that's drug reviewers who can only review new drug applications. They cannot do anything but that. Take them out. FDA lost 1,000 people in the last year. So that means that a 10,000-person agency has gone down 10%. At the time, remember all those laws? At the time when all that new responsibility is coming. And at a time in which imports are flooding in, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now let's just look at the field. After 9/11, we said to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, if you think planes flying into buildings are a problem, think about the food supply. And he got it. And said, I'm putting more people at the border. I hired 600 people. Almost said, we got 1,000 applications the first day for new inspectors. Got them on the borders. They're all gone now. They're actually below where they were in September 2001. Budget cuts. Now, this is the way they look at it. The reason what happens is they don't get their inflation catch-up. It's like you guys, when you're working one day, are making the same money every year, but have to pay more in rent and electricity and whatever you're paying. Well, that's what's happening at FDA. They have an annual cost increase of about 6%, and they've been told you can't get any more. So in their view, just in the last 4 years, they should have $626 million just to keep doing what they were doing in 2003. No new work. Just to stay afloat. They're actually have $450 million. So that program has lost hundreds of people. And that's just the food program. Now, let's talk about a little bit of it. I've given you a sense of, got an agency that done well on some things, hard times on a few things. And in my view, the reason is largely budgetary. So let's talk about what's kind of going on now, the big things that are coming up at FDA. And then we'll segue over into imports. First big issue is drug approvals. So I need to get that. While drug review times are down, which is a good news story, drug development is still 8 to 10 years. And drug approvals are fairly flat. This is a complicated chart, but it was intended to show that the days of the easy drug discoveries are gone. It's getting harder every year. Companies are drilling more dry wells. They're going deep into clinical trials for drugs that don't work, that don't ultimately make it through. And there's a tremendous amount of angst that the drug development process is not able to bring drugs through the other end, and it's taking them 8 to 10 years. So FDA is trying to develop ways to speed that up, but one of the ways is something they call a critical path. The idea is that you would get with the companies early on while they're still synthesizing a drug in the laboratory or doing early animal testing and say, let's try to pick the winners, because it's hard to pick the winners. There are lots of losers that either never get to clinical trials or never get through clinical trials or never get through the FDA approval process. And they want to use things like biomarkers and predictive technology. But they've not been able to get any money. They first asked for $100 million, no, then $25 million, $8 million. EU gets it, though. They realize that that's the next evolution in drug development, which is to buy the winners earlier and get them on the market. They're investing $440 million euros a year in that very thing, and FDA can't get any. So I think that's a real threat to the leadership of this country in the whole innovation area. There is that the FDAR you'll hear about does have a provision called the Reagan Udall Institute, which allows the industry to fund some of these things. So that may help out. Now, let's go to the next one. I don't know if you know what this is, but the point of following biologics, these are essentially generic biologics. You know what a generic drug is? Well, they're biologics. And biologics tend not to they tend to have essentially, to generalize, a patent forever. Because you can't really copy a biologic the way you can a traditional chemical drug. But if the scientists' predictions were true that more and more of the new drugs are going to be biologics, not the old chemical drugs, that means you have the potential for the next wave of drug discovery being essentially a brand name drug forever. Now imagine what that means for cost. If a drug costing $4,000 or $5,000 a dose is never going to have generic competition, it's going to cost that much forever. So imagine what that could mean. So the Congress is deeply engaged in some negotiation to figure out whether they can authorize FDA to approve generic biologics. And of course, the industry that makes the biologics says that's not a good idea. And of course, the generic industry wants to make them, says it is. And so they tried to get that into FDAR, failed. We will see if it happens next year. But that's a big ticket item, potentially, dollar-wise, for the American public in the future. 80% of our drugs right now are coming from India and China. They're usually coming in the form of what they call APIs, raw ingredients, and then they're being finalized, finished by the Pfizer's and Merck's here in the United States. But FDA last week approved the first Chinese final product, and the Indians have been doing that. And I don't want to knock China and India, but the trend toward these products coming from less developed countries that don't have strong regulatory systems is an issue, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. And then, of course, people are saying, well, look at the raw ingredients coming from there, and I can go on the Internet and buy my Lipitor or whatever for 10% of what I'm paying at the local pharmacy. Why can't I go buy this stuff on the Internet? And that's happening. In fact, Congress is going to probably take up a bill this year, and my prediction is if it gets a vote, it passes. There's been one every year. It's passed the House and the Senate, but in different forms. And the House leadership and the Senate leadership have refused to let it conference. But this year, you have Democrats on both sides, and they may allow it to conference. And the president, I think, will probably have to sign it. So we could have a two-tiered drug review system. The stuff in the pharmacies and the stuff you buy at home on the Internet. And that's got some real issues. And we can talk about that if you like. I'm damn near an expert in that. Having been pounded by patients for years, and I get lots of hate mail from little old ladies who say I won't let them have cheap drugs. Going along with these issues is the issue of drug counterfeiting. In some countries in the world, you're more likely to get a counterfeit drug than a real drug. And the counterfeiters are very good. They can make a perfect copy. In Africa, for instance, if you need an AIDS drug, you're more likely to get a placebo than a real drug. In many, many countries, Indonesia, you almost name your country, the former Soviet Union. In this country, we've been relatively free of counterfeiting, although FDA has seen a tripling of counterfeit cases. And they are very concerned because we're the big dollar market that the counterfeiters are really knocking on the door. And, of course, that's why this Internet purchase idea is particularly troublesome in the world of counterfeiting. And we've seen a lot of counterfeiting. The counterfeiters are very good. Not only do they make a good-looking cop, they do things like they'll buy, say, for an injectable, the real drug, and water it down 90%, so that if FDA does a quick lab screen to see if there's any ingredient in there, it'll come up positive. But it'll be so diluted it won't be therapeutically effective. And many of these are dangerous. There was one that I had recently that, as a sample, that the counterfeiter used, I'm told, water out of the toilet. And it was an injectable drug for it was a fertility drug for women seeking to be more fertile for childbirth purposes. And so these patients were actually injecting into their veins septicemia. So this person wouldn't even bother to buy sterile water. But yet they would go to great lengths to make a good-looking package. It looked just like the Serono drug. It looked perfect. So that drug counterfeiting is potentially a big issue for FDA. The veterinary issues at FDA have traditionally been sort of second-tier issues, but they're coming to the fore. Right now, there are fish swimming around in Nova Scotia and other places with an application to FDA to be approved as a new drug application, new animal drug application. And the fish grow, if I had photographs, you'd see siblings that big and younger brothers that big, same age. Because they've been given a growth gene, they don't become giant fish. They just get big fast. It's like you're going from age 1 to age 20 in a year. God forbid. Cloning, same thing. There are applications to FDA to allow clone meat into the food supply. Now, I don't know whether you guys will eat a clone burger or not, but you may not get a choice because they're coming. And then mad cow disease, of course, has been a huge issue. And then mad cow disease is another example, I think, of where policy decisions to keep FDA weak have had tremendous ramifications. Let me give you an example. When mad cow disease began to spread, first in England, as you know, there was tremendous concern that it would arrive to the United States, and we have a big beef export market. Well, FDA did a regulation that said you can't feed cows cow parts, because that's how cows don't get BSE unless they eat these rendered products, which are essentially leftovers from the meat industry. And so FDA did a regulation that feed mills could not feed cows cow parts. You could feed it to chickens, you could feed it to pigs, you couldn't feed it to cows. And so then FDA asked for $20 million to go to every feed mill in the country repeatedly until they were 100% in compliance. Everyone is segregating any of this so-called ruminant material from the cattle feed. And FDA was denied, so it did its best and got a 95% compliance rate, which is pretty good. But then when the first case occurred, the Japanese, which was a huge beef market, billions of dollars, said to the U.S. Trade Representative, what percentage of feed mills in the United States are in compliance? Is it everyone? And the USTR guy proudly said 95%. And the Japanese guy proudly did the calculation and said, that means that several hundred cows are getting fed ruminant materials that may have BSE, and we're not bad, the market's closed. Billions of dollars lost. And in fact, the Japanese subsequently opened it up, and just yesterday, I think they closed it back down again. Because they found a Cargill operation that was not segregating some material. But the point is, for $20 million to get this industry in compliance, there were these huge economic effects, which again, I think was penny wise and pound foolish. So, but the veterinary issue is going to be this cloning thing, it's going to be really interesting to see if the public accepts cloned meat in the food supply. I'm of the belief they probably will not. So, we will see. Now, food safety. You're going to hear more about this from Mike Taylor. I'll just mention a little bit. This is an important point of inspection. When I came to FDA, they were doing 35,000 food inspections a year. Every food firm in the country got in every at least every 2 years. That's pretty good. This year, they'll do 6,000. Remember I mentioned blood safety and other problems that came up with you? Well, they always took it out of the food program. They were the big guys. We'll take a little amount of food. No, 10 million. Well, who cares? So, as you see, is that money flowed out of the food program? And then, if you could have known in 1980, pick a date, that you would have emergence of new pathogens like E. coli 0157 that were lethal and unknown in nature before, if you could have known you had a flood of imports, if you could have known the way the industry was going to evolve, you probably wouldn't have done that. But they did. Maybe I did it. I was part of it, I guess. So as you see, the rate of inspection is tremendous. Every 10 years now, basically, is what it boils down to. And at the same time, that inspection, what's going on? How much going on? Another thing that was interesting is if you plot the Inspector findings at facilities, what they call OAI, official action indicated, they went up on the same curve. As the inspection went down, they went up. In other words, when the cop got off the beat, folks relaxed, didn't worry as much. So when the inspector did get in there, he found all kinds of problems. So to me, it was, you can't prove the relationship, but to me, it's an example of to some extent of cause and effect. But if you plot the MEAT program, and Mike Taylor will talk to you about what he did with MEAT, because he ran that program after he left FDA, they're going the other way. Although there have been some MEAT problems lately as well. Now, let's talk about the impact of that food safety problem. Remember spinach? This lethal condition, HUS, very, very serious for children, the elderly, others. All of a sudden, CDC finds all these cases, some deaths, many hospitalizations. By interviewing people, they determined that it was spinach, but that was the common food. So you've got this connection with spinach. But it's going to take you a while to find it. And of course, FDA is under-resourced and doesn't know exactly where to go. So what are you going to say to the public? You've got deaths, you've got hospitalizations, you've got illnesses, you've got spinach. What are you going to say? What are you going to say? What?
Don't eat spinach.
Don't eat spinach! Right! That's pretty simple. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Weeks later, Salinas Valley, what's the problem? One valley in California. What did that mean? Whole country spinach crop. I talked to one Maryland farmer. He said, I've never had a problem with my spinach in 30 years. I had to plow it under. Lost my entire crop. I went bankrupt. This is why I think the food industry is beginning to figure this out. You know, and what was happening was that the spinach was out in the field, cattle wandering in from the neighbors, defecating on the leaves, or the deer are coming through defecating on the leaves. The workers are coming the next day, picking the leaves, taking it to these packing sheds, spreading it all around, mixing it. All the other farms' spinach is coming, it's all getting mixed in. And so now you've gone from 3 farms to 30 farms. Then it goes from where it goes to 300 farms. And then spinach all over the place is getting contaminated. Now, I will say FDA proposed to the Secretary of Health and Human Services back in February that they do regulations to prevent this from happening, and they essentially got kicked out of the room. So that is a problem, not being able to get the political decision makers above to deal with it. But anyway, huge cost. Huge cost from 3 farms. Okay, bioterrorism. The Secretary of Health and Human Services said the last day he left, Tommy Thompson, that he couldn't sleep at night worrying about bioterrorism. I won't spend too much time on this. Unfortunately, a lot of what I know about it I can't talk about because I can't talk about it. So, I will give this is a Washington example that it's a favorite. The President's budget for this year put in for the Department of Agriculture, $162 million in budget request for the Department of Agriculture to protect farms from terrorists. You know, it might go into tomato fields at night and sprinkle something out. FDA got zero. Now, you're a terrorist. Let's pretend you are. Are you going to go to the farm that's making enough food for a couple hundred people? Are you going to go to the processing plant that FDA regulates that's making food for a couple of million people? If you're a smart terrorist, I think I know where you're going to go. Maybe you're not a smart terrorist. Okay, tobacco. This could be a big deal. There's a bill working its way through. The three principals on this are UVA Law School graduates. So if they screw it up, blame them. That would give FDA regulation of cigarettes. And it's got a good chance of passing, I think. So it would require them to do FDA to set performance standards the way it does for medical devices. It would ban the sale to children of cigarettes and ban some advertising to children and a number of other. It would set up a process whereby a company could make a safer cigarette and come to FDA for approval. And that's going to be a big deal because imagine you're approving this poison because it's a little less poisonous. So that could be a big deal. Fortunately, that bill comes with a big user fee in which the industry would pay these fees, the tobacco companies would pay these fees, and so it would actually be the first bill passed in recent years that came with some money. Now, last topic, that's probably tired of having on here. Imports. We said we'd talk about that a little bit. Hot issue today. First of all, volume. A few hundred thousand a few years ago, coming up on 20 million today. Flooding in. Now, I will say that, folks, we're starting to say to the decision makers in Washington, guys, the import problem's going to be a problem. You don't need to worry about that. But remember, AIDS happened. Blood safety happened. Biotechnology happened. Drug review happened. All those things were going on. All the squeaky wheels were out there squeaking. And nobody was dying from imports, so it was like next year. Well, now you see where we are. So let's talk about that a little bit. What are the problems we see that FDA sees with imported foods? Lots of illegal animal drugs. Imagine you're a Chinese farmer, or a Vietnamese farmer, or a Malaysian farmer. And you have got a great idea. You raise chickens, and you feed the chicken feed, and then you hover their cages over a pond that you put fish in. And then because chickens have a poor digestive system, they defecate into the pond, and the fish eat, and you get twofer on that feed. And then you get a few more fish, but the fish get a little fungal infection, they get a little bacterial infection, they're going to die. So you put malachite green, a banned cancer-causing drug in there, keep the fish alive. And you put it to fluoroquinolones, some antibiotics to kill the bacteria. And so now you have fish that you can keep alive until you harvest it and send to the good old USA. And this is not, I didn't make that up. This is happening every day, guys. And so FDA, they did a survey beginning in 2006 and found 25% of the seafood had this stuff. A quarter. Well, they only inspect 0.7%. Now, for you math majors, what does that mean? Does that mean that 24% is not good looking? Whatever it means, a lot of seafood is a problem. So, filth is common. Filth is sort of like insect parts and bad feces and stuff. Lots of that in these imported foods. Salmonella is a big one. Lots of other bacteria. Lots of unapproved food additives, pesticides that we don't even use in this country, used particularly in Latin America. Lots of heavy metals. And then these are two of my favorites. Remember melamine? You guys wonder what melamine is? If you've got a white kitchen cabinet at home, that's melamine. It's a plastic. But it actually is interesting if you mix it in the feed, it raises the protein content. So it looks like you've got a more expensive, higher quality feed. And that's what was happening. It was mixing in melamine, showing it was a higher quality, getting a better price for it. And when we talked to some of these folks that were doing it, when the FDA talked to them, they said, well, this is common. Everybody's putting melamine in this stuff. What's the big deal here? So it was like, why are you guys back in the USA care about that? And inulin is another favorite of mine. Inulin is a polysaccharide. We were finding for years that the Chinese were watering down the apple juice with sugar water, with high fructose corn syrup and water. And we kept catching them at it and turning back again. Most people are right. Most of our apple juice comes from China. You think it comes from Washington State or West Virginia. Get that. But anyway, the great thing about it is instead of fixing the problem after being caught repeatedly, they add this stuff to it. And this stuff fools the FDA lab equipment so that the test comes back 100% apple juice. So it's just games all the time. But and of course, don't you understand? Remember, they're only looking at 0.7%. So you got to catch it all. You don't catch hardly any of it. You only catch the ones you catch, which is very little. Now let's go on to some other problems. A lot of these countries that are sending us food are developing countries. 20 years ago, most of our food was coming from Britain. And there was some from Mexico and Latin America, but in terms of places like Vietnam and Asia, China and Malaysia, was relatively small. Most of that stuff was going into ethnic food stores. But now more and more is coming in terms of whole foods that we're consuming every day. And they simply do not have regulatory structures. I asked the Chinese FDA, Vistra, just before I retired, I said, when will you have an FDA in China that will be relatively the same as the United States? And he said, well, it'll be decades if they let us do it at all. So, in my view, you don't have the potential. I'll say a little bit more in a moment. But you don't have systemic and systematic food production standards in a lot of these countries. Now, this is an interesting issue. Ascorbic acid, for instance, is a very common preservative in all of our foods. It's vitamin C. It keeps foods from going rancid. When you cut an apple, it immediately starts turning brown and pull ascorbic acid on it. Won't do that. The Chinese are actually selling ascorbic acid, according to one UK study I read recently, at less than the cost of production. And there are almost no U.S. or European manufacturers of ascorbic acid anymore because it's so cheap there. And the same is true of a very common substance in our breads and gravies and soups and all, something called wheat gluten and corn gluten and rice protein concentrate and lots of others. Then you've got governments that are really focused on economic development. And that is clearly the case on some of these rapidly growing countries. And, you know, trade, production is clearly important to them. And you've got cottage industries. In China, it's estimated there are about 1.5 million small producers that are actually the source point for a lot of these foods and food ingredients. And the food is being rallied into larger organizations, distributors, and then going to exporters into the United States. So it's not, don't think of the model that you might think of in this country. I'll give you an example. Oops, I had a picture here, but I must not have it. Maybe it comes up. Let me do this. We'll go back. These are some of the things that are coming. Carrageenan, this is a milk derivative, largely from the Philippines. Ascorbic acid, 80% is being made in China. China makes a lot of citric acid, about 80% of the world's wheat gluten. China. I forget. Gum arabic is a fun one. Gum arabic is in your colas and candies and lots of your foods. It's a emulsifier, stabilizer, they call it. And after 9/11, people realized that most gum arabic comes from Islamic countries. And in fact, there was one gum arabic supplier in the Sudan that was owned by Osama bin Laden. Fortunately, he purchased it to make money, not to do anything nefarious. But the food industry did a very dramatic thing to solve the gum arabic problem. They changed the name to gum acacia so that it wouldn't have the word Arabic in it. But now, I use gum arabic as an example of why MOUs don't work. Because some people say, this is easy. You just say to the other country, you want to remember and understand, we'll produce safe food. We send you, you produce safe food, you send us. Everybody's happy. So I said, who's going to do the MOU with you in Sudan if they don't have a government? And I think that sort of makes that point. So let's just talk about China for a minute. I'm not going to pick on China, but they have been the ones in the news so much. But this is applicable to Guatemala, it's applicable to Vietnam, it's applicable to lots of other countries. Rapid industrial growth, a major source of raw drug ingredients, the ones we're using every day, dietary supplements and over-the-counter drugs. My favorite dietary supplement example is these the Federalese, which is fortunately now banned, but we sent an inspector over to inspect one of the facilities, and he noticed they would, instead of drying the leaves traditionally out in the sun, which took a while, they were laying them out on this huge concrete floor and driving trucks over them to use exhaust to dry them. But they didn't use leaded gas. They used leaded gas. And they didn't have catalytic converters. So they were spewing lead all over this stuff. And the inspector was laughing at me. He said, I just can't believe it. Now I got to tell you, when I did some NPR stuff on that, I got tons of mail from these herbal tea folks. They drink this stuff. You probably do too. Saying, oh, that's not true! Herbal tea is fine! Okay, it's fine, I don't care. Drink it! Now, China again, we're back to China. Okay, China. So let's just look at Chinese food exports. 82,000 shipments in 2002. By 2006, it was 200,000. This year, FDA does 20,000 samples of imported food each year. That's where they take the sample, send it to a lab, and find if there's anything bad in it. 20,000. That means if they only did Chinese food in 06, nothing else from anywhere else, they could have only done 10%. Does that give you a sense of order of magnitude of the problem we got here? And I mentioned the fact that some of these food ingredients are below the cost of production. I mentioned the ash cottage industry. primitive conditions. One of my inspectors went with a congressional lawyer to a drug plant. He came out with the greatest story. He said the FDA guy, who was a drug manufacturer expert, went over to this corner where they were making something. And so he said, I wandered over there and said, what are you looking at? He said, this is so cool. And so the lawyer, who didn't know what he was looking at, said, well, what do you mean? He said, look at this. This is the way we made drugs in the 1920s. You couldn't find this anywhere but in a museum now. Isn't this cool? The lawyer was like, I don't know if it's so cool or not. It's different. And this is a Chinese flour processor. Remember I mentioned vast cottage industry, 1.5 million small producers? 5 or 6 bags a week. Okay? And she's not selling to Cargill. Cargill gets it. She's selling to somebody who's selling to somebody who's selling somebody who's selling to Cargill. Now, imagine the Chinese government, if they had an FDA, trying to find her and inspect her and tell her to get the dog out of the plant and wash her hands. So as someone said, this would be like President Garfield going to Montana in the 1880s and telling some cattle ranch or what to do. I have a good friend who was the trade rep for China, negotiated the most recent trade agreement with China. He said that the Beijing government has essentially no idea who these people are, no idea where they are, and no influence over them if they could find them. So I tend to believe that. So the question then is, and I'm trying to lay the groundwork for the discussion of solution, because I'm not trying to beat up on the Chinese. If they have an evolving economy that's producing this, you can't rely on them to fix the problem over there. Does that make sense? Okay, so one other example. Let me give you another one that's kind of gross. Mushrooms. A lot of our mushrooms were coming from China. And we kept finding they were growing it in what they call night soil. Anybody know what that is? All right. Well, I was talking to a reporter recently. He said, he lived there for 10 years. He said, it wasn't uncommon for you to order a fresh green salad and get a little bit of toilet tissue. But they were spreading the night soil onto the vegetables. Now, again, you don't do that. That's not a good thing to do. Now, I mentioned this A.T. Kearney study because it's interesting. They said they were actually asked by the Chinese government to say, what do we need to do to create a modern food safety system? And their study resulted in, you need to invest $100 billion. That's a chunk of change, guys. That's a lot of money. And they gave the example of, they need just to move food around, keep it cool from spoiling. They need 365,000 refrigerated trucks. They have 30,000 in the whole country. They need 5 billion cubic feet of cold storage. They have 250,000. Does that give you a sense of where they got to go? And, of course, keeping food cold from spoiling is sort of a fundamental thing you do, right? So, what can FDA do? Now, for those of you that know something about the Act, there is a section called 801. This is the provision I mentioned goes back to 1896. It authorized the inspector to open the barrel and look inside. And back in those days, it worked fine. Most imports were staple goods. They were flour and molasses, things like that. You could literally open it up and look for insect infestation, mold, mildew, other common contaminants of the day. And now it worked fine. I once went back and looked at some old records and found in 1920, only 10,000 imports. Manageable number. Not 20 million, as we saw a minute ago. So the authority is, FDA can look at the food, and if it appears to be adulterated, they don't have to prove it. If it appears to be adulterated, then they can deny it entry. Now, of course, one problem is a lot of things that get denied, put it on a boat in Philadelphia, take it back out, come into Boston and re-enter it there, and the chances of it getting caught twice. Remember, they're only inspecting 0.7%. So the chances of it getting caught twice is basically zero. So, another piece of data. There are about 400 ports of entry. Well, some people will say 300. The reason for the difference is in some areas they have more ports. Like in L.A., you've really got 3 or 4 ports. Some people count it as 1, some count it as 3, whatever. There's a lot of ports. FDA has a total number of import inspectors of 450. In other words, they can only man 40 of the ports, and most of those are part-time. Like at Dulles Airport, they'll send someone out for a couple of hours on Thursday morning, maybe the next Monday. That's about it. that really aren't there. And as I mentioned, inspection rate of less than 1%. And I mentioned earlier, 20,000 food import samples tested each year. Last year, China alone sent 200,000. So the paradigm puts all of the responsibility on this organization called the FDA to find the problem and either let the food in or deny it entry. That was the paradigm established in 1896, and authorized in 06, and reauthorized in 1938 that exists today. Now, the meat paradigm is entirely different, and I don't know if that's on here or not. We'll see. Now, you might say, well, we'll go to the other country and inspect there. Remember that map I showed you? Thousands of facilities? How many do they do? 125 last year. With the budget cuts this year, we'll do 100 food facilities. 100 out of tens of thousands. The 341 drugs is actually misleading because most of those are what they call pre-approval inspections that are paid for by those user fees I mentioned, because a facility must be inspected before a new drug can be approved. We really only do about 100 drug inspections. Devices, biologics, notice no cosmetics. Most of our doctors suffer from coming from China through inspections. And again, a lot of facilities out there. Now, what can policymakers do? All right, if you're sitting in Washington, you're the president, you're the secretary, you're the commissioner, whatever you are, what am I going to do here? I've got this problem, the public's outraged, the toys have lead, the food's got animal, the seafood's got illegal drugs, whatever. The pets are dying. So first of all, you can have more, you put more people at the border, open more containers and look at it. Problem is, you'd almost need to give the FDA, U.S. Army to do that, and I think they're occupied elsewhere. So you really can't get enough people to open 20 million things and do any kind of reasonable examination, and that number, of course, keeps going up. Now, you can go to the other country and inspect. Hugely expensive, and with that kind of inspection, you've got to tell the other country, ask permission, give them a long lead time. So after melamine, they go, you know, the FDA guys go to the Chinese government and say, we want to come look at the facility that made that stuff. We're trying to figure out what happened. So the Chinese take 2 weeks to give them a visa. They finally get over there, team three. They go to the facility, big warehouse facility. Place has been scrubbed completely clean. All the equipment's dismantled, pushed into a corner. All the employees have been sent away, and the manager has been sent to their version of Siberia. In other words, nothing to see, nobody to talk to, and no records. Now, I'll let you decide. The Chinese said, we didn't need this facility anymore, we shut down. The other view that some might have is the Chinese didn't want you to see anything. I'll let you decide which you think happened. The point is, you got to tell them in advance, and who's not going to be ready when you get there when you tell them in advance? A domestic firm gets a surprise inspection. So, will foreign inspections work? I don't think so. Now, the next thing, demand visitors by the foreign. Say to the other government, you're not going to sell us food unless you tell us you're going to have safe food. And you do this MOU. Well, again, if that country is incapable of setting up a regulatory structure to do that, what good does it do to ask them to do that? And I think when you're talking about developing countries, that's the answer. And then, of course, change the paradigm. In other words, go from having the FDA guy open and look in that container to something else. Now, let me talk about the USDA authorities, and Mike will probably spend more time on this, but they were also created in 1906. You've probably heard about the jungle, and it was supposed to be a socialist treatise, but it turned everyone's stone because they had a little bitty piece in that long book about a meat packer and the disgusting conditions in a meat packing facility. So USDA for meat can basically say you must create a meat packing plant in Germany or wherever, just like one in Des Moines, and have inspectors there and do everything as if it was an American facility. Then USDA will go there and pre-certify that facility. They'll periodically go back and re-inspect it. Then when the meat arrives here, they will inspect it again. And they will say to the meat packer, you can only bring it in through these 10 ports that we designate where we have people. Remember, FDA's got the 400. So they got lots of inspectors, and they only have to worry about 10 ports. And then, of course, they inspect the entry. And then if there's a problem, USDA can suspend that country or suspend that facility in a heartbeat. Now, which of those did FDA have? Obviously, the one in the town. So, a little bit of difference, I think, between USDA. Now, people have said, well, why don't we just give FDA USDA's authority? That would be great, except that would mean FDA would have to have the manpower to go to 130 or 40 countries, inspect and certify thousands of facilities. It couldn't be done in a century, I don't think. I mean, in other words, it needed to be done in 1940. can't do it in 1907. So, again, repeat the current paradigm, established a long time ago, it's based on inspection of the border, denying entry if the product's violative, no accountability by anybody but FDA. Totally reactive, not preventive. So what's the solution? You need to build prevention into the product life. So you need to say to everybody, you now have some responsibility for these products. You need to worry about where you're getting it, who his supplier is, all the way back to that lady in that house in China, so that everybody is warned about it. Then there need to be greater standards in the foreign countries. You need an international agreement on standards. The Chinese say that chlorofluorocarbons are not that dangerous in fish. Well, whatever we say they are, they say somebody needs to reach an agreement on that. And then you need an FDA. You need an FDA to set up preventive measures that then inspect the appeals. So in my view, the need is for a new paradigm. You need to get away from the border inspection and move to responsibility and accountability across the supply chain. Cargill does this now. Many firms do. Walmart does this. They say, we're going to buy a vacuum cleaner from China. We want to know what you're putting in it. These are the specifications. If it doesn't meet them, you're not selling us any more vacuum cleaners. But of course, if the vacuum cleaner doesn't work and you take it back, they give you a no. If you get sick from the food, a little bit different. Oops, not too far. And then lastly, you need some FDA resources to oversee and inspect foreign countries. You need FDA to set the standards for a prevention system, and then go to foreign countries and understand what they're doing so that the system will actually work. And that means some money, and I certainly hope Congress will come through. I think that is it. Yes, that's it. Okay. Any help at all?